you know, you do this once a year. I'd sure rather be at the White House Correspondents' Dinner Week than at CES, you know, in Vegas in January.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby.
It's Monday, April 22nd, which means it's Media Monday. Today, I'm joined by John Kelly to talk about the week that press critics love to hate, White House Correspondents' Dinner Week, and the party rodeo that precedes it. We also dig into the search for new leadership at ESPN following the ouster of Norby Williamson, and whether the famously insular network will actually tap an outsider to help steer the company into the streaming and digital future. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Monday, everybody. Welcome to The Powers That Be. If it's Monday, it is Media Monday, of course. I'm talking to John Kelly. We're going to talk about rumblings at ESPN. John is going to give his track-by-track review of the new Taylor Swift album. But first, John, it is White House Correspondents' Dinner Week in Washington. We've mentioned that Puck has a very fun event with WME and Snap this week in Washington. There's a lots going on, as always, lots of parties. Snap has a separate little thing we're excited about in D.C. But I want to step back for a second, John, and just reflect about this week, because I feel like this is a good topic for Media Monday and the Puck audience. There is a terminal, never-ending debate about this week and the parties. Like, does it show that Washington is too cozy with people in power? That is something people kind of started to admit and say out loud, reporters, I'm saying, during the Trump years. You know, there was some self-reflection that maybe it's because Trump was skipping the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Maybe it's because political reporters realized that this whole enterprise of Washington journalism should be taken a little more seriously during the Trump years. But it seems like everyone's kind of reverted to form now that a somewhat normal president is back in the White House. I don't know if you want to get into an academic conversation about this. You know what? I don't think we need to. I think that conversation is probably a little too serious. Every industry likes to give itself awards, pat itself on the back, schmooze, etc. They do it in D.C. They do it in Silicon Valley. They do it in the music industry. And, you know, it's to be expected, I guess, that they would do it in Washington journalism. What say you, my friend?
Well, you know, I remember when this sort of backwater event kind of mainstreamed a little bit, I guess, during the Obama era, when there was an extraordinary amount of enthusiasm. I mean, you were in the town, Peter. You were the king of the town. You would remember better than I do. But this was a sort of dreary, very Hilton-y thing. And then all of a sudden, it was a date on the calendar. A lot of media companies showed up. the party took on a life of its own. There was a, I mean, I remember seeing the red carpet scene in the Washington Hilton, right? You know, by Calorama and Embassy Row. And I just thinking, what has happened here? I mean, truly, what's Gayle King doing here? But there was a certain glamour that befell Washington in that era. The Obamas were obviously very glamorous. And politics was the biggest story. I think also it reflected like a post 2008 enthusiasm. We people forget now, but you and I are getting old, so we remember it. That Obama began his first term, you know, amid this nightmarish once in a generation depression, the auto bailout, etc., and things continued to improve for him and his administration. And so by the second term, there was really a Camelot vibe. And I think that played out at the Correspondents' Weekend. I could care less about these conversations about people being too cozy with each other. And, oh, like, people should be able to talk. And I think that the Trump era, when this party just, you know, went away, or, you know, when the centerpiece went away and it became just like a frat party weekend in Washington, you know, that was dispiriting. And so it's fine that everyone knows everyone. Washington, as you remind me all the time, is a small town. It's a small southern town in a lot of ways. You know, the day ends at 5. Every time I'm in town, I look around at 4:30 and say, Jesus, what's all this traffic about? Because the agencies, you know, sort of end their day around 4 o'clock. You see the smallness and the occasional insularity of it. But I think, you know, you do this once a year. I'd sure rather be at the White House Correspondents' Dinner Week than at CES, you know, in Vegas in January. So I don't think it's the end of the world. And I'm very excited for your conversation with Aaron Sorkin that you and Matt are leading at our party on Thursday in partnership with WME and Snap. I think that it goes without saying, we got the coolest party of the week.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. Send me your questions. If anyone has questions for Aaron Sorkin, let me know. I think that'll be fun for all the West Wing dorks.
Who plays Josh? That's the question.
Who plays Josh in 2024? Yeah, no, I mean, I'm also tired of the sort of endless debates over this weekend. I feel like we did that. It's okay. Like, everyone go have fun. Everyone go have some cocktails. There are just some, like, interesting just backdrop dynamics that I was thinking about the other day. Because I haven't really been, I mean, I went to so much of that stuff during the Obama years and the last couple years of the Bush administration. And I haven't really done the party circuit for a few years now. And I was remembering being, like, when I was at CNN and you're, like, in your 20s and, like, you trying to get invited to the parties, you know, and you're like asking people if you can get in. There's like that little dynamic. It is funny seeing which like celebrities still show up every year. There's a sort of small group of celebrities who started coming during the Obama years, and like they keep coming back. I'm thinking of like the guy who played Stamper in House of Cards. That guy's always there. Like, he's been going for like 10 years. And like, I don't know. I'm sure I looked at his name, Michael Kelly. I'm sure he's been doing lots of interesting stuff since then. And on the side, he's perfect for every sort of like DC thriller show / movie. There's just, like, that caliber of celebrity, pseudo celebrity. They're just like always at every party. Like, oh yeah, that guy, you're still here. So I'm interested to see like which top tier celebrities and B-level celebrities come. Colin Jost is hosting the actual dinner this year, which should be funny. I mean, I like Colin Jost. I like Weekend Update. But, you know, my biggest memory is obviously being at the dinner when Donald Trump was getting roasted by Barack Obama. Yep. And I think it was Seth Meyers, right, that year?
And Obama made that joke about how, you know, hey, Hillary, couldn't have made it any easier for you.
I just remember, like, I was at the CNN table, and the famous footage of Trump, like, you see the C-SPAN camera or whatever pool camera it is, and you see Trump's profile. So you see the kind of, like curly Q swoosh of his hair from the side looking, just scowling at the stage. And that was also my view. I could see, like, his face directly to my left, I think, when I was looking over at him. And look, who knows if that changed the course of history, that roast at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I don't know if it did or it didn't, but it was certainly a moment. So I'm excited to go back. It's good to be in DC in the springtime and see a lot of old pals. Although we did see a lot of them at the last puck party we had at the French Ambassador's residence about a month ago. So we'll just pick up some conversations where they left off. John, I want to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about a search for new leadership at ESPN. Welcome back to the Powers That Be, everybody. I'm talking to John Kelly, of course, on Media Monday. John, our colleague John Orend, wrote a piece late last week about the search to replace Norby Williamson at ESPN. John writes that ESPN is famously, almost infamously, the most insular company in sports media. I feel like I've learned more about ESPN from John's reporting in the last few weeks than I have since the James Andrew Miller book, Those Guys Have All the Fun. I'm learning a lot. Norby Williamson was, to use a big puck word, defenestrated from his role after almost 40 years of being at the top of the network, close to the top of the network at least, beloved by some, perhaps not by others. Newcomer, Gen Z / digital star Pat McAfee roasted him live on television. ESPN denies that was the reason that Norby was kicked out. But, you know, the knock on him, according to John's reporting, is that he was too married to the linear age of ESPN as it tries to sort of navigate new streaming ambitions. What do you make of some of the names that are out there to replace Norby at ESPN? And can any of these people, you know, make the company more digital friendly, more direct to consumer, figure out how to make money in a way that, and by the way, get audience and eyeballs in a way that they haven't been able to in recent years?
Well, I'm with you also that John's reporting's been revelatory to me. You know, we are members of the sort of ESPN generation that grew up with Patrick and Oberman on SportsCenter. Norby was the producer on that show. You know, he started his career, and Norby is like, I mean, he has a great name. He's like a fashion designer or like a European soccer player. Like, he's a one name only guy in that world. Started his career.
I was thinking more
like
a Dr. Seuss character, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's true too.
The Norbys go to Connecticut.
it's a Dickensian name. I mean, it does sound like someone who's just kind of constantly sharpening his knife, you know, but started his career in the mailroom, was a problem solver and a talent whisperer, and ascended to the top, basically, you know, right below Burke Magnus, who was right below Jimmy Pitaro. And they can say all they want about it being a difference of opinion, but don't fuck with Pat McAfee. I mean, they paid the guy a fortune to come here, and McAfee called him a rat on television. That's yikes. It's crazy. But what's fascinating to me here is that ESPN is insular. I mean, it's in Bristol, you know, and people work hard there because what else are you going to do? You're going to hang out in West Hartford all night, you know? And they have rights with every single league. They have, the SportsCenter franchise is sprawling. It's a place that burns people out, but also intoxicates them because of its hold in the culture still. It is surprising that they're going outside the fold here. That is a big surprise. It is interesting to me that they are contemplating Jim Bell.
I saw that.
Do you remember Jim Bell?
That does not suggest a move away from the linear era, that's for sure.
No, that made my eyeballs open wide. Jim Bell, to me, is sort of a Zuckerite in a lot of ways. He was also a Today Show producer early in his career. He was the guy, if you recall, who created Operation Bambi, which was the, I shit you not, that was the code name inside NBC for how to defenestrate, drink, everyone, Ann Curry in a pre-canceled Matt Lauer era when they put her in the Today Show seat, and I think she kind of stunk up the joint. The ratings were terrible, and all these old guys just inevitably blamed the woman for it. And Jim Bell was the one who you know took her out to lunch at Brasserie Ruhlman and tried to see if he could put all these like special correspondent things in front of her. And anyway, she didn't. And you listeners of the show will remember that painful on-air goodbye they had, and then Jim ended up running the Olympics, had a big career at NBC, left. I think that they tried to Bataro tried to bring him over a number of years ago when Connor Schell, our pal, left ESPN to start his incredible production company. So I imagine that it's Jim Bell with a bullet. I think he lives in Greenwich, so it would be a logical hire. He's already.
Yes, you do have to convince these people to move to the greater Bristol area, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. I know. Which is appealing only if you grew up in Rhode Island. It's actually astonishing to me that the greater Bristol area has not gentrified around the fortunes of ESPN in the last number of decades. I mean, you know, when you hear about people who live and work there, they're like going to Starbucks and staying in Westins. Like, it's not Cambridge, you know.
It's not. Where's the place where Walmart is based?
Bentonville,
Bentonville Arkansas. Bentonville has put up like fancy wine bars and like all kinds of amenities for all the traveling salespeople that come to town.
No, I think in Bristol you can just take like the Aaron Hernandez walking tour, you know. So it's not that's not one of the perks of the job. But the big thing is that ESPN has this incredible agenda to fulfill that Iger's put them on the spot for. They're going to roll out ESPN Plus. I mean, they're clearly going to break ESPN out of Disney, I think, at some point. They're going to break the financials out, and then they'll sort of let the market decide. I think this ends up being the thing that probably prevents Jimmy Pitaro from getting the Iger job, that he'll be the CEO of a publicly floated ESPN. And I think that will be the inevitability there. But in the meantime, they're going to start a new streaming service that engages the rights. They're going to spin out this Spulu product that we keep hearing about. And part of what did Norby in was that he was an old school linear dude, and they want to bring in somebody who has streaming knowledge. And again, to your point, Peter, I don't know if Jim Bell is that guy. I don't understand the tactical details of that world well enough to be able to make a value judgment clearly, but they want fresh blood as they figure out how they can monetize these revenue streams. And to your point about eyeballs, and this is like the thing for people like us, ESPN is it is mother's milk. I literally can't imagine a day of my life without interacting with an ESPN product, whether it's the app or, you know, ESPN via YouTube TV where I get it, or the page, or listening to Pardon the Interruption, the podcast when I come home from work. But it benefited and created the greatest business model in human history, which was the pay TV bundle, mm-hmm. where every cable subscriber for the last 20 years has been paying $10 a month for ESPN, whether they wanted it or not. And now, as you say, they have to focus on eyeballs. They have to focus on the people who actually want to watch the women's college basketball and college sports package that they just paid $800 million for, which may have been an incredible discount. They have to figure out, do people really want to watch baseball tonight? Are they going to pay for it? You know, is there enough of an audience around the UFC? It seems like that's actually potentially, you know, going to be on the table again. And that's been beneficial. They have to focus on eyeballs. And that's and they are like honest and humble at the high levels of that company that it's going to be a different kind of business now. And they need talent who has not benefited from that 20-year period where they just stood head and shoulders above everyone else.
Yeah, I think that my biggest takeaway from John's piece was that ESPN, you know, and the times they've had to find new leadership has always tapped someone from within. When George Bodenheimer left as president, they went to John Skipper, and then, you know, John Skipper led into Jimmy Pitaro, who, you know, these are all like sort of Disney ESPN insiders who were promoted. And all the names that John is suggesting in his piece are outsiders. And it's just having, you know, it's hard to come in as an outsider to a place that's been around forever, has its culture, has its people. And look, for as many changes as happened over the years, Norby is a good example of a kind of person who exists in television. While leadership changes at the top, while the faces you see on television change, the guts of these places are very often like people who have been there for decades and decades. Like, that was my experience at CNN, like people who had been there for a very, very long time. I'm talking about like the sat truck operators and like the HR people and certain producers. Like, there's just a culture that emerges when you stay at a place for a very long time, and it'll be interesting to see if they do bring in someone from outside, how they fit in. And look, I think I lived through four different presidents at CNN. I think Zucker was the only one who came in. And, you know, after some growing pains and poop cruises, you know, finally was able to kind of win over the rank and file. So it's possible. But, you know, again, as John mentions, ESPN is a famously insular and protective place. And I'm fascinated to see who they tap to steer the ship.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, the Licht story is on many levels a fable about how hard it is to create any kind of change in an institution. He was outnumbered. The benefit here may be that the Norby role is sort of a number three that's going to turn into a number two. There's just some protection. Like, Pitaro is a CEO. Magnus is going to be the guy. Is clearly the sort of heir apparent there. Whether this thing ends up going public, whether it Pitaro ascends it into a, if he gets the Disney job potentially, or you know, there's some other shuffle. So this person will have a little bit of cloud cover, but dude, you are right. I mean, you want to come into one of these places and say, hey, I got some great new ideas that you guys have never tried here before. And it's going to be hard. Dylan talks about this a lot on this show and in his work when he discusses Kim Godwin, who is in charge of ABC News, that I believe was the number two at CBS News. And she arrived there, and the culture very much said, well, why are we listening to this person who didn't even have the top job at a rival who we defeated in every measurable category? If you bring in somebody from Turner Sports or even Amazon, I mean, you know, ESPN's ESPN in this world. Everyone else is trying to compete with it. And there's going to be a buy-in challenge. Pitaro is a lovely guy, and I think he is very collegial and could probably probably has the skill to sell this internally. But like, you hit it on the head, man. That is not an easy message to sync with a large organization, especially during turbulent times.
For those of you who've been waiting around for 20 minutes or so to hear John's review of the new Taylor Swift album, that was a joke. I will say there's a track on the album called Peter. I'm not going to say it's about me. I'm not going to say whether it's about what me and Taylor had. I'm just going to let that sort of linger out there on the internet. I will not
does
be answering
Katie
any
know
questions
this?
About it.
Oh man,
she does now. She does now. Yeah, she does. You know, after that 2 a.m. drop
Travis Kelce
last
know
Thursday.
This is going to be.
I don't want Travis Kelce to know about this. John, thanks so much, man. I will see you tomorrow in the District of Disaster.
Yeah, I can't wait. See you down there.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.